In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In 1726, a woman in Surrey seemingly gave birth to rabbits. In 1749, an advert appeared claiming that a man could climb inside a wine bottle on stage. In today's episode, I spoke to Ian Keeble, who's the author of a new book called The Century of Deception, about some of the most audacious, bizarre and inventive pranks that fooled 18th century Britain. What kind of pranks did you uncover in England's Century of Deception, as you call it in the title?
Yes, when I came to write the book, I wanted to have as many sort of diverse possible hoaxes. So there were a lot to choose from, but I sort of picked out the ones which I thought were most interesting and most fun and most entertaining. So they cover all areas, I guess, of hoaxes, from sort of literary hoaxes where William Henry Ireland decided that he wanted to forge Shakespearean papers and eventually came up with a full play called Vortigern, which he forged, down to the outwardly very amusing Mary Toft, who claimed that she gave birth to rabbits. I mean, a couple of other, which are very different. George Psalmanazar, who claimed that he came from Taiwan. It's now Taiwan. It used to be called Formosa back in the 18th century and wrote an entirely sort of fictitious book all about the island and its history and what the inhabitants apparently were up to. And then you've got something like the rather bizarre Cock Lane ghost, where this ghost comes back from the dead and claims that she had been murdered. So you can see, yeah, a whole spectrum of different hoaxes involved.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll dig into a few of those in more detail later in the conversation, because I'm sure people will be very intrigued by vengeful ghosts and a woman giving birth to rabbits. But before we do, what are you defining as a hoax here? So how is a hoax different to, say, a financial scam or a con, for example?
Yes, I think it's sort of my own definition, which I had to sort of do for the book, I think. My background is actually as a magician, as well as hopefully a researcher and an amateur historian, I would call myself, of the 18th century. And I specialise in comedy magic, although occasionally my audiences dispute that title. And I think that a good hoax has all the same attributes as a good comedy magic trick, in the sense that they should both be fooling, but they should also be amusing at best. And I do like to think that the perfect hoax does have that sort of attribute. In practice, as I discovered when I went through my the 10 hoaxes, which I talk about in my book, I think only one of them actually really can be categorized as both amusing and entertaining, because the other hoaxes all seem to have a sort of element of sort of revenge or an element of cruelty about them, perhaps, all sorts of differing reasons. But the one motivation which most of them don't have, in fact, I think only one of them really has, is a financial one. Very rarely are hoaxes done in order to raise money, if you like, to profit the individual who's doing it. And under that definition, I think they do differ very much from a financial con or a scam, which is always financially motivated. So in that sense, a hoax, in theory anyway, is much more benign, although in practice that isn't necessarily how it turned out. I also make a sort of distinction, because people talk about, I mean, if we look at sort of modern day hoaxes, things like the sort of flat earth, or, you know, whether we landed on the moon or not, that is more of a category, I think, of a conspiracy theory. And I think a hoax can perhaps turn into a conspiracy theory, in the sense that when the individual who first did it, perhaps the person who did the first crop circle did it as an amusing joke, but then people took it on board and people actually believed that aliens did these remarkable figures in the ground, and it then develops into a conspiracy theory. So I do think my distinction is you have a hoax, you have the financial con and the scam, and then you have the conspiracy theory, and the hoax falls, yeah, flatly into how, between the two of them, if you like.
Which somehow makes it way more intriguing, the fact that people weren't just doing it for money, that their motivations are often a lot more difficult to unpick, aren't they, in the cases that you look at?
Yeah, when I wrote this book, because putting my sort of magical hat on a little bit, there were two areas which I was particularly interested in hoaxes, I think. And one of them was why people fell for them, which I think is very intriguing, which we can touch upon. But the other reason, indeed, is the motivation. Why did the individual carry that out? And sometimes it's obvious. For instance, my favourite hoax, I guess, which is the most benign one I was talking about earlier, is the bottle conjurer hoax, where basically an advertisement appeared in a paper that a man would climb inside a bottle on the stage of the New Theatre in the Haymarket. Unfortunately, although the audience turned up, the performer didn't. But the reason for the hoax was basically to test the credulity or the gullibility of the English people at the time. So that is very sort of clear cut. Whereas perhaps the one where even today and back then they've got no idea what the motivation was is the one of Elizabeth Canning, the maidservant, who alleged that she was kidnapped and had her stays cut off by a gypsy called Mary Squires. And she was imprisoned in this, what was effectively a brothel, for 28 days, surviving on literally a loaf of bread and a bit of water. And then she made her escape after 28 days and returned home to her mother. And later it turned out that she'd almost certainly sort of made up this story, but we've really got no idea why she made it up. Even today, and she went to her grave saying that, you know, the story was true. And so you had these two sort of extremes, if you like. And most of the hoaxes, I do reckon I've hopefully come up with why they did it. But as I say, some of them are rather harder than others.
Very intriguing. So as you mentioned, you are a magician yourself, and which gives you a very different perspective, I think, than a lot of the authors that we talk to on this podcast. How does that give you a different perspective to look at these old hoaxes from?
When it comes to performing magic tricks. Obviously, what the audience are just seeing is the trick. You know, they're seeing what we magicians like to call the effect. And what they don't know, or hopefully don't see, is the method and the thinking behind performing that trick. And I think a hoax has the same attributes in some ways. We see the hoax itself, but what we don't necessarily see is the background to it. And a very good example of this, I think, is Mary Toft, who... perhaps the most famous hoax of the 18th century, in the sense that she claimed that she was giving birth to rabbits, which outwardly just seems absolutely absurd. Why would anybody possibly fall for, even back in the 18th century, why could you possibly believe that somebody could give birth to rabbits? But there were two aspects to that hoax, which I think drew people in. One of them was a sort of theoretical one. There was this idea of sort of maternal imagination, which said that women who perhaps had some sort of shock or came across some what they used to call monstrosity, like somebody without an arm or something during their pregnancy, that could somehow transform itself onto the embryo and they could produce a child, you know, who was deformed in some way. And Mary Toft fitted this theory very well because she used to be a hot picker in a field. She had a great longing for rabbits. She used to eat rabbits, apparently. She dreamt of rabbits. So she had a rather unhealthy interest and attraction to rabbits, so the theory would go. And this somehow transformed itself to the embryos, and she started producing rabbits. So you've got that sort of theoretical background, and backed up with that, you've got this woman who was just a brilliant actor. You know, she was acting out childbirth. They said literally up to sort of 23 hours in length was she supposedly pretending to be in labor. So convincing was she that some of the male midwives said they could actually feel the rabbits jumping in her belly. And on top of that, obviously, in order to produce the rabbits, to put it rather crudely, she had to insert them before they could come down. And the male midwives were saying, there's no way she could have done this because we were watching her for all this time. But as a magician, I know that it's very easy to distract audiences, to misdirect audiences. And she had like 23 hours to do it. She had accomplices. There would have been lots of moments when there would have been the opportunity to do what she needed to do. And the doctors would have still been convinced that they were watching her all the time. And this is true of magic tricks as well. People say, there's no way you could have produced that card out of your wallet because I was watching your hands all the time. But the answer is that they weren't, because at a certain moment we were able to misdirect them to think that they were watching when they weren't. So I was bringing these type of magical instincts and theories, if you like, to look at some of these hoaxes.
Sounds like Mary Toft could have made a good stage magician in the 21st century.
Yeah, I think so. And somebody actually who was even better than her in some respects was a young woman called Anne Robinson, who was a maid servant, a maid for Mrs. Golding. And this is the Stockwell ghost incident, which was essentially one of the earliest poltergeists, supposedly, where objects in the house were thrown around and broken. And at the time, they had no idea how it was done. Again, all the witnesses to the event said they were, you know, they were watching the maid. There was no way that she could have done it. But afterwards, she made a full confession. And it was almost like she was explaining how her magic tricks worked, because she said things like she put sort of wires, which she was pulling when people weren't looking, to make the objects fall off. She dropped some sort of chemical substance into some water, so it sort of boiled. She was throwing objects when the people weren't looking. Most of the people involved were fairly elderly, so it was relatively easy for her to sort of run rings around them. And then she made this wonderful statement, which, again, in her confession, where effectively she said, well, the reason why they were taken in partly was because they were exaggerating what they saw. And this is the classic response to spectators who are fooled by magicians, because they tend to exaggerate what they saw, partly because the magician points them in the right direction, but partly because they want to explain to other people that how impressive the trick is, and that there's no way that they could be fooled. So if they make the trick sound much harder than it is, then it's harder for people to come back and say, well, you should have spotted how that was done. And that was precisely what the witnesses to Anne Robinson were doing. They were claiming, you know, crockery was dancing, and they were giving exact measurements of how far a vase would be flung across the room. So they were clearly exaggerating the story in order that they would impress the people who were recording it. So again, a perfect magician at work in the form of Anne Robinson.
With Anne Robinson, it sounds like there was a lot of effort required in some of the pranks that she pulled off, as you say, setting up wires and chemical agents. Why was she motivated to do it?
Well, the claim later when she made her confession was that she had a lover and she wanted to get her mistress, who was Mrs. Golding, out of the house so that she could have an assignment with her lover. So that's the reason that she sort of started doing this, to frighten the woman out of the house. But obviously she got such a kick out of it that when they moved into the neighbor's house, you know, in order to seek refuge, the same thing happened in the neighbor's house. And then she transferred to yet another house. Her niece, Mrs. Golding's niece, came on the scene and took her over to her house. And again, the same crockery was falling all over the place and pots. So she obviously started, maybe that was her motivation to begin with, but then it just became great fun. She could obviously see all these people running around scared. I mean, it only lasted about 24 hours because she was sent away on an errand, and of course all the activities ceased. So they worked out that it must have been her. So when she returned, she was then promptly given the boot.
Do you think that this was a particular golden age of hoaxes and pranks?
I think it was, from my perspective, well, perhaps from the 21st century perspective, partly, I think, because I think some of the pranks that did take place could not have taken place later. I mean, for instance, the Mary Toft, I think, but, you know, by the end of the 18th century, people would have had acquired enough medical knowledge to know that there's no way that somebody could produce rabbits. Similarly, the Cock Lane ghost, this idea of a ghost coming back and somehow accusing somebody of a murder, I think that would have been more questionable, again, as we sort of get more into the Enlightenment and realising that such matters couldn't happen. Also, just knowledge about a place like Formosa or Taiwan, again, you know, there would have been more knowledge 100 years later about the country, therefore there's no way that somebody could have made up all these ridiculous facts about it. And perhaps, again, with the Shakespearean forgery, as people became more aware of how of Shakespearean writing and analysis of his work, again, it probably would have been harder for somebody later on to have got away with that. But yeah, there's just something about these which I think make them particularly amusing and special.
Something that comes up again and again in the book is this idea that you mentioned earlier in reference to the bottle conjurer, of English credulity. What can you tell us about that idea at the time? And was it a fair reputation? Were the English particularly credulous?
Yes, English credulity seemed to have crept in actually at the time of the bottle conjurer hoax. And it was this idea that somehow the English were particularly gullible. And I think it was very much tied up with a sort of xenophobic attitude towards the foreigners, particularly the French and the Italians. So there was this idea that these people were coming over and gulling us, as the term was they used to use back then, taking advantage of our good nature. I mean, there's a classic cartoon of a Englishman who's represented as a sort of John Bull, you know, nice jolly figure, and then a nasty Frenchman coming along and sort of picking his pockets. This was actually to do with a balloon hoax that took place in 1784, which was a man called Chevalier de Moray, who said or tried to make the first flight in this country of a manned balloon. It had happened in France the year before. Unfortunately, his balloon really wasn't up to it, and he charged money to come and see him take off. But unfortunately, the balloon singularly failed to inflate. And after 3 hours, he had to sort of give up, and a mob sort of attacked him, and he had to sort of run for his life. But what appeared in the press afterwards was here was this Frenchman, as they called him, who was deliberately once again trying to fool the nice Englishmen by charging them to come and see him fly in the balloon. I mean, ironically, he wasn't even French. He was actually Swiss. But this sort of comes up again and again, where if some event happens, it even if foreigners aren't involved, somehow they are assimilated into it and accused as being part of it. I don't think there's any evidence to back it up, but it is a phrase that just is used again and again once it started, this idea of English credulity, and it's reprised and repeated right through to the end of the 18th century.
And some of the pranksters that you look at will be familiar to listeners. They're familiar names, one of whom is Jonathan Swift, who took up a campaign which I would say we could characterise as essentially trolling of the astrologer John Partridge. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Jonathan Swift's campaign is one I particularly admire, actually, because he was having a go at an astrologer, a man called John Partridge. And astrologers were very big back in the 18th century. They made a lot of money by selling their almanacs. They were making predictions which were always open-ended, so it was hard to disprove an individual prediction that somebody might make. So, for instance, they would say a lawyer is going to come to a high post, but they would put a question mark against it. So if the lawyer did come to a high post, they could claim they were right. And if he didn't, well, you know, it was only a question anyway. Or they might say, good news from France, although not all might be of that opinion. So, of course, that covered both ways, because whatever the news was, you could take it either as good news, although you might not take it as good news. So it's very difficult to attack these astrologers. What Jonathan Swift did, because he particularly had a dislike for John Partridge, who was very against the policies, particularly in the religious world of what Jonathan Swift believed in. So he basically set himself up as a sort of phony astrologer under the name of Isaac Bickerstaff. And he made a prediction, and his prediction was very specific. He said, on the end of March 1708, John Partridge is going to die of a fever. And this sort of turned astrological predictions upside down, because they were never, as I've mentioned, ever that specific. And John Partridge found it very hard to deal with it. All he could really do is say, well, I'm not dead. but obviously this took time to respond to, because he was had to wait till his next almanac came out. And in the meantime, as you say, Jonathan Swift, sort of on top of making that prediction in the original almanac, he then produced a little letter where he basically pretended to be somebody who'd been to John Partridge's deathbed and actually witnessed his death. And he also wrote an epitaph on him as well, an amusing epitaph. Apart from being an astrologer, John Partridge was also a cobbler. And also a sort of quack doctor, because he would use his almanacs to sell his rather dodgy medicine. So Jonathan Swift wrote this little epitaph, and one of the lines was, here 5 foot deep lies John Partridge, a star monger, a cobbler and a quack. Weep all you customers who use his almanacs, his pills, and his shoes. So a very sort of amusing response to John Partridge. And when John Partridge came back and said, look, I'm still alive, Jonathan Swift came back again and said, well, I don't think you are, because nobody who was actually alive could write such nonsense as you write. So it was this sort of amusing, attack on John Partridge, which was very successful, really, in making him look a bit feeble. And I think it also sort of undermined almanacs to a certain extent.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I'm not sure if you would see that today. I don't think you would see well-known and famous figures necessarily getting involved with hoaxes today that turn up. So again, it seemed to have more impact, if you like, at the time in involving influential and important people.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
You mentioned earlier William Henry Ireland, who made forged Shakespearean texts, essentially, and also wrote an entire play and managed to get people to go and attend. What can you tell us about how he managed to pull off this coup, as it were?
Yes, William Henry Ireland was the son of Samuel Ireland, and Samuel Ireland was a successful sort of writer and engraver, but he was absolutely obsessed by Shakespeare. He desperately wanted a Shakespearean signature. I think there were five known Shakespearean signatures at that time. And he sort of travelled to Stratford-upon-Avon to buy Shakespearean memorabilia. He was obviously slightly gullible because he bought a chair that apparently belonged to Anne Hathaway and that Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway had a sort of cuddle in it. So he was obviously a man who was slightly gullible, but was also extremely obsessed by collecting anything to do with Shakespeare. His son was much brighter than his father thought he was. His father was always very sort of rude about him and sort of put him down. And I think possibly that his motivation to begin with, his son, was in order maybe to get the sort of affection of his father. So he began to discover Shakespearean ephemera. His backstory to this was he'd met a man who was called Mr. H, so he never actually discovered what his full name was, who surprisingly has a chest of Shakespearean documentation. And he is quite happy for William Henry to go along and sort of help himself to this documentation, which he does and hands over to his father. But what's very clever about William Henry is he doesn't start off by producing an entire new play written by Shakespeare, because if he'd done that, nobody would have believed him. But he starts off with very small items, very unimportant items like a sort of bill of exchange. So very boring item. All that it has about it really is that it's got Shakespeare's signature. And he sort of hooks his father in by that method, because everybody there at the time think, well, why would anybody want to bother to forge such an unimportant document? And then he produces sort of invoices, and eventually he goes slightly high. He produces a profession of faith, which Shakespeare had apparently written. I mean, at this stage, there begin to be some sort of warning bells, I think. the spelling which he uses a lot of E's on the end of words. But by this time, because his father's accepted the early work, it's very hard for him to then say that a later work is questionable. I mean, he does question William Henry comes in with a drawing, which is a very crude drawing, which he said was by Shakespeare, and his father says complete nonsense. But then the son produces a letter which sort of mentions this drawing, and at that point, you know, the father buys it. So eventually he comes in with this complete play, and by this time his father is totally convinced that these documentations are originally done by Shakespeare, and therefore accepts the play, believes it to be genuine. And he even sort of invites people around to his house to look at his documentation, and he gets them to sign a book to basically say, yes, we agree that this is this documentation which you have is genuine. So he's using sort of confirmation bias, if you like, from his friends in order to substantiate his theories. And eventually, yes, for one night of this play, it's staged. It's actually not as bad as one might think, and in some ways it's undermined because the leading actor, a man called John Kemble, really doesn't believe in the play. He thinks that it is a forgery, and there's this line which is in the play which goes, "And when this solemn mockery is over," and before he delivers that line, he pauses, he sort of looks at the audience, basically winks at them and says, "And when this solemn mockery is over," and pauses again, and the whole audience sort of burst out into laughter. And that's basically the end as far as this play is concerned. It only has that one night. But again, it's just this way of slowly suckering his father into it. And there are people who think that Samuel Arlen knew all about it, but I don't. I just think that the way William Henry did it was very clever and very sort of devious, bringing his father in so that by the end his father was willing to believe anything.
So clearly he played the long game, and he wasn't the only prankster to do so. So George Psalmanazar, who you've mentioned before, he carried out, I mean, almost a lifelong hoax that he pretended he was from Formosa, now Taiwan. What kind of lengths did he go to convince people of his identity? And how did he get away with it for so long?
Yeah, again, that's a fascinating story, George Psalmanazar. I mean, he's obviously started very young pretending to be somebody else. He actually earned money by pretending to be a pilgrim, going to Rome and pretending to be from Ireland, and he was sort of used to beg alms. He spoke fluent Latin and was very convincing with that. Eventually, in his sort of late teens, he joined up with the Dutch army for some reason, and it was during that time that he pretended at first to be actually from Japan. And he began to adopt what he felt were the customs of Japan. He sort of made up a Japanese language. And then he met a man called the Reverend Alexander Innes, who was a clergyman, and he saw through George straight away. But together they sort of concocted this idea that he would convert George from the heathen religion of a far eastern country to the Anglican faith. And together they might be able to make a name for themselves. But they decided at this stage to drop Japan, a little bit too well known, and go for Taiwan, or Formosa as it was known back then, which is just off the coast of China. And that's what they decided to do together. And having determined that, and I think part of the reason George was willing to go along with it, because at this stage he wanted to get out of the army, and he saw this as a sort of ticket to get out, because Alexander Innes wrote to the Bishop of London and said, "Look, I've made this amazing conversion. Would you like to meet him?" So at that point, George had to convince people that absolutely he was from Formosa. So he started again. He adapted his language to be now Formosan. I mean, to the extremes that he went, he started eating raw meat, which he said his digestive system was able to cope with, again, in order to demonstrate what a strange country he came from. So having sort of adopted this pose, he then comes to London, where he's immediately accepted by the Bishop of London. And I think that's part of the reason he got away with it, because you had this very authoritative figure going around telling people that George Psalmanazar was generally from Formosa. And, you know, he was the top of the Anglican Church, so people obviously went along and believed him. And this often happens with hoaxes. If you've got an authoritative figure who you know, shows that, apparently demonstrates that the hoax is true, then more people are likely to believe it. I mean, there were lots of things that you would have thought were against him. I mean, the fact he was a white man, you know, with blonde hair. How on earth could he possibly come from Formosa? But he always had a response. He was brilliantly clever. On that case, he said he came from a very wealthy family and they didn't let him outdoors much back then. And this sort of shoehorned into the racial stereotype of that time that, you know, the colour of your skin was dependent on how much you were exposed to the sun. I love his debating as well. I mean, he was actually approached by Edmund Halley, who would later become the Royal Astronomer, who tried to catch him out. And he said, at what angle, he asked him, does the sun hit the hearth when it comes down the chimney in Formosa? And George said, I got no idea. Edmund Halley said, it's above the Tropic of Cancer. Of course, it comes straight down the chimney. And George's response, well, in Formosa, we have crooked chimneys. So end of that argument. So basically, he had lots of attributes that made him get away with it. He was, by all accounts, a very pleasant young man. He didn't seem to have any vices. He wasn't a drinker. He wasn't a womanizer. He didn't seem to be exploiting his fame particularly. And therefore, those people who believed him in sort of invested him as a nice young man. He was a perfect example of somebody who would convert to the wonderful Anglican faith. He had a phenomenal memory. Whatever he said about Formosa, he never withdrew it or never retracted it. And again, it's quite hard to argue with somebody who sticks to the same line always. He was never caught out. And he put this into his book as well, because when he wrote this entirely fictitious book about Formosa, whatever he'd said to somebody in public, he actually put that in the book. And the best example of this is he claimed that the Formosans worshipped a sun god, and on New Year's Day, they sacrificed 18,000 small boys to the sun god. And this comes out in the book. And of course, people said, well, this is absurd. You know, wouldn't this depopulate the island very quickly? And what he did was he said, well, when I said 18,000, that was the maximum number, but the priests in their discretion could sacrifice less. And in any event, if they ran out of boys, they could always move on to girls. So he had these sort of wonderful answers. And the other great thing he had going for him is that Formosa wasn't that well known. Certainly not the entire island. So even when people said, well, I've been to Formosa, it's nothing like what you're saying, he would say, well, you've only been to the perimeter of the island. I lived in an enclave in the centre of the island, and our customs were completely different from those people on the external part of the island. So all these factors, the ignorance about Formosa, his convincing stories, enabled him to get away with it for quite a long time. And having sort of started down that path, it was very hard for him to retract it, I think. So he couldn't exploit it after a period of time. Obviously, he had to move on and earn his living elsewhere, which he did, actually becoming quite a good hack writer. And he also became very good friends with Samuel Johnson. In fact, Samuel Johnson said he was George Psalmanazar was the man he most admired, but not because of his fictitious stories over Formosa. He said he wouldn't even talk about China with George. It was more to do with the fact that he, towards the end of his life, he clearly became very religious. I think he became very hardworking. And I think Samuel Johnson really admired that aspect of George. And he went to his grave, still claiming he was from Formosa, but he wrote this autobiography, which was published posthumously, where essentially he tells the story of how he got away with it.
It's so interesting that a lot of people really sound like they kind of busted him, but he was able to just keep it going, perhaps because he was so amiable and people didn't want to challenge him too much.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, that's true of, if we look at sort of conspiracy theories, there are lots of people who bust conspiracy theories, but there's still a whole collection of people who still believe in it. And I think that was true of George. You know, a lot of people were extremely sceptical. I'm sometimes asked, is there a modern-day equivalent of George Psalmanazar? And I usually mention Uri Geller, actually, because I think when Uri Geller first burst on the scene, I think it was back in the 1970s, but I think people, he appeared on the David Dimbleby show, and he bent a spoon. And I think that probably 99% of people watching at that time genuinely believed that he bent the spoon by the power of his mind. if you turn around to today, I think, you know, 99% of people probably think that it's done by trickery. I'm not making any comment on that. But the point is that Uri Geller still claims today that he can genuinely bend spoons. And I think that's almost like George Psalmanazar, if you like. He's still living, because what's the advantage of saying at any point, you know, no, I made it all up. There's no advantage in doing that, really. So just keep it going and have fun with it.
My final question to you would be what all of this can tell us about the 18th century more generally. Maybe the anxieties of the age, the preoccupations of the age, or perhaps that there was a kind of an environment where really exciting, fantastical stuff like this could emerge.
Yes, I wouldn't want to exaggerate the impact of hoaxes. Obviously, I'm looking at a very sort of niche subject, and you'll rarely see a hoax appear or mentioned in a historical book about the 18th century. But I think what it does do is tell us something about the people and the times. I think one area which it does show us is how information was disseminated back then, because when a hoax like, for instance, the Elizabeth Canning hoax or the Bottle Conjurer hoax or the Mary Toft hoax, they appeared in newspapers and journals, which is what you would expect. But also back in the 18th century, you had pamphlets. Pamphlets were very common then, which tended to be comical or trying to make a point. And for the Elizabeth Canning case that took place in 1753, there were no less than over 40 pamphlets devoted to this subject, which shows how much people were interested in the subject, but they were buying all this information about it. But not just reading matter of journals and newspapers and pamphlets. There was also satirical prints, effectively sort of cartoons, 18th century equivalent of cartoons where hoaxes were depicted. So that was another way that people got information. You know, this is obviously pre-photography, so that people could see the imagery of the people involved. I mean, Mary Toft, the rabbit hoaxer woman, was very notorious, and an engraving was made of her, which was sold again so people could see what she actually looked like. There was also court transcripts. Two of the hoaxes, which I look at, the Cock Lane and the Elizabeth Canning, had court cases, and these are reproduced in tremendous detail in court transcripts. And also theatrical reproductions also of the hoaxes. Back then, they used to call afterpieces. They used to have the sort of main event, which is often a Shakespearean play. And then they would have what we would think of maybe as a pantomime or a farce that would be an afterpiece that would happen after the main event. And it often involved a harlequin. He was a sort of stock comedic character. But what they would do is they would incorporate topical events into these afterpieces, just like we do in pantomime today. You know, we put in Brexit or the coronavirus into our pantomimes. So they used to do that in the 18th century. So the Mary Toft rabbit hoaxer case pops up in theatre, the Bottle Conjurer does, the Cock Lane ghost, the Stockwell ghost as well, all pop up in these afterpieces. So we can see, as I say, how information is disseminated. So I think that's one aspect of the hoaxes, which is really interesting. Another one, I guess, is, yes, it does tell us something about people's beliefs at the time. Obviously, with the Mary Toft, tells us the medical knowledge wasn't that great when it came to the production of rabbits. We know about the belief in ghosts and the belief in witches as well. And also, perhaps, in the Elizabeth Canning case, you had Mary Squires, who was this gypsy. There was a lot of xenophobia around her, tied up with anti-Jewish sentiment as well. And again, she's incorporated, and actually in the engraving, she's reproduced as a witch. So again, it's telling us something about how people feel. It also tells us something about the disparity between men and women as well, because it's interesting in the hoaxes I look at. Most of the men who perpetrate the hoaxes tend to be wealthy men, well-off men of sustenance, whereas all the women are obviously poverty, from poor families, They are in areas of occupation, fairly basic ones like sort of maid servants or a hop picker in a field, as Mary Toft was. And the women, in my view, are much more enterprising and have to work much harder for their hoaxes than any of the men do, who tend just to sort of write something down from comfort and perpetrate the hoax by sitting and study and writing it out in some capacity. So I think, again, that tells us something about Georgian society. And finally, perhaps, there was a general interest in hoaxes and about the reliability of information. It was interesting that somebody said when the Bottle Conjurer hoax took place that somebody wrote and said it wouldn't have been great if the Bottle Conjurer had actually happened, i.e. this man had actually gone inside an ordinary sized bottle and sung and danced inside it, because it would disprove David Hume, who had just written about miracles at the time, and his sceptical attitude towards miracles. And, you know, if this Bottle Conjurer had worked, this would demonstrate that perhaps David Hume was not correct in his philosophical theories. I think, again, Samuel Johnson got involved with the Cock Lane ghost, of which a lot of people poured scorn on him later on. But the reason he was interested in investigating whether the ghost existed is because he was very interested about the idea of an afterlife. And if he could actually prove that a ghost could come back from the dead and give information about something which was not known about on the earth, i.e. that somebody had killed somebody by poison, this would definitely demonstrate that an afterlife existed. So that was part of the reason he was interested in that. So, yeah, there's all sorts of undercurrents and interesting aspects. And sorry, I said the final point, but one other final point is that you get some really interesting people, you know, people like Samuel Johnson and Ben Franklin and Jonathan Swift, the Duke of Cumberland, who was the second son of George II, involved in these hoaxes. I'm not sure if you would see that today. I don't think you would see well-known and famous figures necessarily getting involved with hoaxes today that turn up. So again, it seemed to have more impact, if you like, at the time, in involving influential and, you know, important people.
That was Ian Keeble. His new book is The Century of Deception: The Birth of the Hoax in 18th Century England, which is published by the Westbourne Press. It's on sale now, and you can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow, when Neil Oliver will be speaking about 100 moments that defined world history.